in about the December timeframe. Each of the 12 thematic areas, the lead in each of those, and I'm responsible for thematic area 4, engaging with society, based on what we've heard during our presentations at ERPA 13 in our sessions that we organized, we've been asked to create 2 PowerPoint slides. First slide being, what do we know today about engaging, in our case, engaging with society? And the second slide is challenges for the future of the profession in engaging with society. The purpose of this session is to engage with each other and help inform me, and there's a number of us taking notes here today, what do you feel, or what do we collectively feel, do we know about engaging with society today? You know, what's kind of the state of the art today? And what do we see as challenges for the future of our profession of radiation protection in engaging with society into the future? And you'll see Friday at the closing ceremonies, Ted Lazo, who you met on Monday morning and probably run into in between, he will present these 2 slides, or the slides that we produce for each thematic area, in the summary during the closing ceremonies on Friday. So the purpose of this session is a discussion between ourselves, and we'll be taking notes, is what do we see as the current state of the art in our profession engaging with society, and a second slide on challenges for the future. And in organizing this session, just as background, in case you missed the plenary, we've got some world-class folks in on our plenary, and I thought it'd be productive for them to share with us quickly their thoughts on those 2 subjects. So again, I've asked Vincent Covello to join us here and give his five minutes on what he sees as the state of the art in engaging with society and challenges for the future. Helen Grogan, who is at plenary, to share her views, 5 minutes on those 2 subjects. Mr. Ogino, the same. And then we thought, gee, what if we actually got somebody that was not a radiation protection professional that has previously been engaged with the radiation profession but is not a radiation protection professional to share with us their perspective, a non-rad protection professional perspective on what our profession knows today and what they see as challenges for our profession in the future. And originally I had 2 folks of that nature, Paul Dorfman and Lorraine Mann. Paul sent me an email a couple of days ago and said he was visiting a sick friend, and the sick friend had norovirus. He now has norovirus, and he wondered if it would be a good idea to come, and I thanked him very much for his enthusiasm and his dedication, but I asked him to please not come. We didn't want this Congress to be recognized as the Congress where all 1,500 delegates went home with norovirus, okay? So Paul's not joining us, but Lorraine was kind enough to join us today, so this will be a different perspective on our profession, and we're looking forward to that. And the fact that she has not spoken to us before, I've asked her, given her 10 minutes to share with us her perspectives on that. And then Marku Kostelainen is a dear friend for many years, and he participated in a 2010 ERPA regional meeting here in Europe, and they talked about this subject. They talked about the guiding principles for stakeholder involvement, engagement that ERPA has produced. And so he's going to share us some information on that. And again, since he hasn't spoken previously, given him 10 minutes. And then we'll open it for just general discussion. So you might, you know, collect your thoughts. You can tweet your thoughts, you can email your thoughts, and we'll have a gentleman that's been kind enough to run the microphone around. So we can just discuss it orally. So it depends on which technology you're more comfortable with. You can do all 3 of those or just 1 of them. This is being recorded, so the speakers will need to speak into microphones, and the audience, you'll need to raise your hand, be acknowledged, and get the microphone to you, and then we'll acknowledge you and engage in our discussion. Any questions on the format today? Wonderful. And I will go ahead and introduce the first speaker. Our first speaker today, we have the esteemed pleasure to once again hear from Dr. Vincent Covello. He's the founder and director of the Center for Risk Communication in New York City in the USA. He's nationally and even now more internationally recognized researcher and expert in risk communication, specializes in helping individuals and organizations respond to the concerns of angry or upset people and communities. He has authored more than 25 books, over 100 publications, and most recently, two very good, and I highly recommend you read publications for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S. So, Vince, your 5 minutes.
So you mentioned what I'd like to do in 5 minutes is what I did yesterday in 1 hour, and I felt that was a bit of a challenge because there are nearly 8,000 articles on risk and crisis communication, and I tried to reduce those 8,000 articles to 1 hour. So now I'd like to reduce those 8,000 articles to 5 minutes. Before I actually start, I would like to thank Rick Jones for inviting me to the conference and to NAEI for their support. It's been extraordinary being here. As I had yesterday, I talked about the number three, so I have three recommendations related to what the field needs in order to improve its effectiveness. Number one is, I tried to make a strong argument yesterday that we have a requirement to acquire specific and new communication and listening skills. The second is we have to pay more attention to the careful preparation and planning of crisis communication. And third, we want to share the information and practice with our partners. In that regard, the first one, acquire specific and new communication skills. I lay out a number of these skills in best practice, not only in my presentation yesterday, but also in one of the two documents that Rick Jones just mentioned, which I wrote for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is on message mapping, which I would consider to be one of the more important types of skills necessary in today's world. The second is I would encourage you to, for those who are able to attend the session last evening, dealing with stakeholder engagement, Trish Milligan from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission talked about an Entergy project where they've developed answers to the 400 questions that I posed in the first document, the NRC document. Those are 400 questions that typically come up when there's a radiological emergency. In the NRC document, I didn't attempt to answer the questions because I argued that they really should be answered locally. And one company now has actually done that. They've taken all 400 questions and have published a document with all 400 answers following best practice in risk communication. And second, I would argue that we have to add to these list of questions for which we have message maps. One example of that is the National Council on Radiation Protection. I'm currently serving on that together with Helen on a project dealing with long-term recovery from a nuclear accident or nuclear detonation. And there's a number of additional questions that come up in long-term recovery that wouldn't come up when you're dealing with the event itself. The second point I made was that we need to more carefully prepare and plan. What always strikes me as interesting about the radiation field is we spend so much time and effort planning, preparing for an emergency operationally, but we don't spend equal amount of time upon the communications. I would argue that they're a right hand and left hand. It's almost impossible to be effective in today's world without effective communication. In that regard, in terms of best practice related to planning and preparing, I tried to lay out what the research literature says about planning and preparation in the second document that I wrote this year for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And this was called Developing Emergency Risk Communication Joint Information Plan for Such an Emergency. I also would point out that the Nuclear Energy Institute in the United States currently has a draft document that goes into more detail than the Nuclear Regulatory Commission document that talks about joint information systems. I would argue these have a universality to them, that if we all plan, prepare based on the same foundation, that the likelihood we'll be successful is much greater. And then finally, National Council on Radiation Protection, they're also doing a lot of deep thinking related to how would we best communicate to the public, particularly related to a concept called optimization, where you involve stakeholders in decisions about how much to clean up after a major radiological. It's a two-year project, and again, Helen's part of that, and I believe it's exactly in line with what I'm referring to, is that we want to very carefully think about not just what we do operationally, but also how we communicate to stakeholders in such a situation. Third is, in order for us to be more effective in our engagement with stakeholders, that we have to put more effort into sharing information and practicing with partners in advance of a crisis. In that regard, I would argue this conference itself is a prime example, where we're sharing information, perhaps documents that you weren't aware of. I did a search, by the way, for those two NRC documents that I mentioned that I wrote on message mapping and joint information system. They appear on page 2004 on Google, which means that if you were searching for it and you didn't know the exact title, all you knew was a few things, it'd be very difficult to locate them. And so these conferences are important as a way by which we can share information with each other. Finally, I would very strongly encourage that you would do this type of sharing and practice at the international, national, regional, and local level. With that, I think that's 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Covello. Really appreciate that perspective. And in fairness to the other speakers, I didn't ask or expect them to do PowerPoint presentations. So, you know, one's not preferred over the other. I just asked for their views. So at this point, I'd like to introduce Dr. Helen Grogan. She's trained as a radio ecologist and has almost three decades of experience evaluating exposure and health risks to the public from radionuclides and chemicals in the environment. Principal researcher for Risk Assessment Corporation, managing the technical aspects of projects which focus on dose reconstruction, emergency response recovery issues, and assessment of radioactive and non-radioactive hazards. She's also been on National Academy of Sciences, Environmental Protection Agency, and Nuclear Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements boards and committees. Dr. Grogan.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Rick. Is that working?
Yeah.
I'd also like to thank everybody for this opportunity to be here. I really appreciate that, being invited by you, Rick, and the rest of the IRPA people. So, talking about stakeholder engagement, where are we now? I think we're coming to grips with everything on stakeholder involvement. We need to recognize that stakeholder involvement is not an add-on or an afterthought. It's an integral part of the decision-making process. And I believe we're getting there. We still have work to do, but I think that, especially when I see a meeting like this, we really are recognizing how integral stakeholder involvement is. And that to be effective, stakeholders have to believe the information that we communicate to them. And so that this means that we have to establish trust and credibility. Where does the trust and credibility come from? I think we recognize that it comes from sound science. We underpinning everything to do with the radiological aspects. We need good science, good data to support what are the recommendations or decisions we want to make. We are now recognizing the importance of transparency in the entire process and also responsiveness. We have to be able to respond directly and preferably quickly. We also need to make sure that we take actions that go beyond what's just generally expected if we really want to build trust and credibility. So there's the side where we are at the moment of working towards establishing that trust and credibility. The other side that it comes from is communicating what it is we have to say, and Vince just now has really addressed that issue and the importance about how we communicate what it is we want to be recommending. The other thing is to recognize that trust and credibility have to be earned and that it does take time. You don't walk in and automatically have this. And I think that's one thing that we are all recognizing as a group in radiological, on the radiological side, that we don't have automatic trust and credibility. And so we have to earn that. It takes time. And so we need to be constantly looking for ways to do this. Not after something happens, but right now. That's one thing I think that all of us can do more for, to really look for ways to increase our trust and credibility right now. And finally, I'm not sure if we're all there yet, but we ourselves have to believe in and see the value of stakeholder engagement. So we have to be really committed to the process. And if we demonstrate that and we can see the value of it, that comes through, and the stakeholders recognize that we are genuine in our actions, and that also helps. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your views with us. I would now like to introduce Mr. Ogino. He has affiliations with the research scientist and certified radiation protection supervisor. He is Radiation Safety Research Center in Central Research Institute Electric Power Industry in Japan. His positions currently Secretary General of the Asian and Oceanic Association of Radiation Protection and Vice Chair of the Steering Committee of Risk Communication in Japan Health Physics Society and Vice President of Young Research Association in Japan Health Physics Society. Dr. Ogino.
Thank you, Rick, for giving me a great opportunity to make a presentation today here. First, I apologize for using a very similar slide as the yesterday's plenary session, Engaging with Society. But today, I want to emphasize the essential point what I want to say today. So this is a very complicated slide, but I think it's very important to discuss based on the practical situations that we experienced after the Fukushima nuclear accident, especially about the engaging with society and stakeholder involvement in decision-making process. As you can see here on the right side hand, in existing exposure situations, in general, stakeholders were not appropriately engaged in decision-making process, such as usage restriction of schoolyard and designation of deliberate evacuation area, and target those in environmental remediation and new food restrictions. And you can find the numerical values such as 20 millisievert per year or 1 millisievert per year. These numerical values are given clearly, but there were not enough explanation or engagement about the engaging with the society. So I think this is a very big problem, and this is a very big challenge for the professionals, how to engage with the society and how to engage with a non-professional in RP. And in this context, the Japan Health Physics Society has been discussing how to deal with the non-professionals in the society. And the JHPS has published the documents, as you can see here, and you can download the JHPS publication from this URL. So please read and please send some message to us. We are very happy to receiving that. And as I have already explained yesterday, the JHPS has established a Q&A site and in Japanese. And as of today, more than 1,500 questions and answers are available on the website. And I want to explain the procedures how to deal with non-professionals in Japan after the Fukushima nuclear accidents. In the early phase, we just say, don't worry. We just add some few sentences, two or three sentences. But in that case, the public still has some kind of anxiety for radiation. Then we change the procedure, like as you can see here, the steps. You can find four steps. The first, respect and carefully respond all questions. And secondly, state objective facts in plain language. And thirdly, modestly add personal opinion of respondent. And finally, do not defy the dignity of JHPS. So how about the social response? There are a positive response and negative response. Speaking in the positive response, they are honest to all questions and reliable. Each answer is provided by plain language and based on plenty of knowledge and expertise. And quantitative answers sound reasonable, not just saying don't worry. But on the other hand, in the, speaking in the negative response, all opinions saying don't worry stirs up more anxiety, and those calculations are not reliable. And the other opinions has been provided by other experts who appear in the mass media. So this is a very big problem in Japan. So in very short summary, we have been engaging with society through JHPS Q&A website, and we have been providing questionnaires, objective information with personal opinion in plain language. And we have been so far receiving a positive social response. In speaking, the risk communication or Q&A activities, the most important thing is confidence. The public has a feeling that they are not being lied, so this is a very important point when we think about the Q&A activities. And we have a plan to continue these Q&A activities until the end of fiscal year 2012. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. Now we get to hear a fresh voice from a different perspective. It's my great pleasure to introduce Lorraine Mann. She spent many years as a campaigner trying and ultimately successfully to expose major and extensive safety and contamination problems at Dounreay nuclear establishment. Over the years, she has amassed a considerable amount of experience and expertise, having been involved in settings as diverse as major public inquiry, the European COWAM program, and the UK Food and Agricultural Countermeasures Working Group. So I give the floor to Dr. Mann.
I'm not a doctor. I'm just Lorraine Mann.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you.
I'm finding that the presentations I've had so far very interesting, and thank you again very much for inviting me to speak at this event. But I think that the issue that we're looking at now is that those who are in the nuclear industry and associated with the nuclear industry have got very good at ways of telling us things and giving us information about things that they want to give us information about. What they haven't been so good at is getting the information back the other way. And the thing about it is this. In risk, in any kind of risk you care to mention, only a wee bit of it is actually to do with the science and the technology. Most of it is psychosocial. People have different views of risk. You all know that we're all meant to eat 5 portions of fruit and vegetable every day, or you put yourself at risk. Hands up the people who ate 5 portions of fruit and vegetable yesterday. A couple of hands. Part of that, you have to factor in how we as human beings behave and the different issues that we have that make us have different evaluations of risk. So we take different views when something's an elective risk or a non-elective risk. Natural disasters, for instance, are very often something that we just can't do anything about. Smoking cigarettes is something that we can do something about. And again, I won't ask people in the room, but there will be a number of people in this room who, despite all of the scientific evidence, continue to smoke cigarettes. It's an elective risk. They choose to do it. The rest of us choose not to do it. We balance out the risk versus the reward to us personally. And we also take a different view on risk for us and risk for other people. And that's where NIMBYism comes from. People are happy for other people to take a particular risk, but they certainly don't want them to be exposed to the risk themselves. And that becomes even more the case when we look at the risks that we're prepared to accept for ourselves and the risks that we're prepared to accept on our children's behalf. And the level of risk we're prepared to accept for our children is far lower, generally, than the level of risk we're prepared to accept for ourselves. our view of risk also changes over time. Mark and I were discussing some of the Dún Laoghaire issues that I've been very familiar with, and he has too. At one time, dumping large items of intensely radioactive waste in an unlined and fractured shaft with water running through it, including stuff that was contaminated with sodium, was considered to be a perfectly acceptable risk by the scientists who were then working at Dún Laoghaire. Well, you know, when you look back at that, we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s. It wasn't that long since people were dying in the trenches, being shot out of the sky in aeroplanes or whatever. And when you set it in historical context, actually, it wasn't that big a risk. But today's society has a different perception of that risk. And so I suppose the first point that I would really want to make is that engagement with the public is not about you building trust so that you can tell them what they ought to think. That is paternalism, not public engagement. Many of the consultation exercises that we've had and I've been involved in, the emphasis is on the first part of that word, con. The decision has already been taken. Governments or the nuclear industry or whoever already know what they intend to do. But they consult because they have to consult. But there's no intention of actually changing anything or listening to anything as a result of the consultation. In the future, I would like to see a situation where engagement was real and meaningful. I would actually like to see you stop doing a lot of the engagement you're currently doing, because you have absolutely no intention of listening to or responding to much of it. The things that you do need to engage people on are the things where you do have an open mind and where you are prepared to make changes according not just to the science, but according to the psychological and social issues, according to things like game theory, which are part of the whole raft of things that you should all be looking at. And you should be outlining where you are consulting with people. You should be very careful to say what parts of any decision you can move on and what parts of decision you can't move on. Because that will affect the views of people like me as to whether we wish to become involved in your consultation or not, whether it's actually worth the candle for us. I did have a PowerPoint, but I've actually got one with me, but I'm not using it. But the first slide in that PowerPoint showed a lit candle, and it had the title, "Is it worth the candle? Public engagement." And the last slide had a blown-out candle. And the reason that the last slide had a blown-out candle is because I'm not so active now in much of the anti-nuclear stuff I was doing before. But when I was active, I could have spent 365 days a year and more on public consultation events of one sort or another. That wasn't what I was there to do. There was one particular consultation that came from BNFL, a big stakeholder event, which was going to run over a number of years. They were intending having between 6 and 10 two-day workshops each year. Well, 2 days means 4 by the time you've done the preparation work and your travel and so on and follow-up work. And they had invited about 25 stakeholders, I think. And they were, if you multiply all that up and you allocate, say, a consultancy rate of, let's take a really cheap consultancy rate of £300 a day, you're looking at somewhere between, a cash transfer there, of somewhere between £18,000 and £30,000 from voluntary organisations and non-government organisations and private individuals to the nuclear industry to do their work for them. And that's morally wrong. When you get in opinions on the science and the technology, you buy in consultants. When you ask people like me to come and speak to you, I'm very fortunate that my travel expenses are being met, but you're not paying me anything for my attendance here. I'm taking 1.5 days off my work which has nothing to do with the nuclear industry, to come here and speak to you. There will be very few people in this room who are not getting paid for their attendance here today. We have to have more of a sense of equity and fairness between both the skills that the public and society can bring to the table. And when you say non-professionals, I mean, I have one very nice little story of my friend Betty, who lives near me. And at the time of Chernobyl, she was in a private water supply. And I don't know how many of you can remember that far back. But private water supplies were considered to be a particular risk because in high levels of high rainfall, which we were. So her water supply was tested and she phoned to inquire about the test results. And they said to her, don't worry about the test results. They're fine. They're okay. They're within tolerable limits. And she said, well, can I have the figures, please? Can I have, the sieverts, the becquerels, whatever? And they said, you wouldn't really understand it. I said, well, I have got a PhD in physics. Try me. And that's the sort of thing. We are non-professionals in one sense, but actually many of us are professionals in various other senses. And we have stuff that you should recognize that you need to know. So I think in the future, what I would like to see is a genuine two-way public engagement where the public and society are being involved on exactly the same basis as consultants in science, radiation protection, or whatever else you might be looking at, where we're getting paid for our involvement just as you're getting paid for yours, and where our views on the psychosocial elements of risk, which form a much bigger part of how risk impacts on people, are at least as valued as the scientific aspects of radiological protection are. Thank you very much.
Wonderful, and thank you for sharing your views with us. Love that fresh, new, good opinion, good information for us. Thank you so much for that. And our last presenter, Marku Kostlianen, is an inspector at STUK, Radiation and Nuclear Safety Authority, in the Radiation Practices Regulation Department. In his day-to-day role, he works mainly with regulatory stakeholders in research and industry. Marku's interest in stakeholder engagement and involvement stems from his early working career at Atkins, where he also worked on Doonesray Particles Project. He is currently working toward a PhD at the University of Manchester and is due to submit his thesis, which is entitled Stakeholder Involvement, an Integral Part of Radiation Protection Decision Making, in the coming weeks. He was also participated in the development of the ERPA Guiding Principles for Radiation Protection Professionals on Stakeholder Engagement. And the floor is yours. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for coming to hear us here. And I think it's a very important topic that we are discussing here today. And it was a pleasant surprise to come here today and see Leanne Mann from the Doonesray Particles Project, which is really something that got me involved in this whole stakeholder involvement in the first place. I worked in the UK for a few years with Atkins, as I said, in different kind of public engagement projects. And then I jumped ship from the consultancy side and moved on to the regulatory side and have started looking at it from this side and have realized that we have learned a lot from stakeholder involvement. We have done a lot in the past 10 years, but there is still a lot for us to learn about stakeholder involvement. But why I'm here today is I'm really here to tell you about greetings from IRPA 2010, the third European Congress. And what did we discuss about stakeholder involvement there? And I will just go shortly through that, and then I will give you a short view of my own view after that of what I've done in my PhD. But nonetheless, in 2010 Helsinki Regional IRPA Congress, we discussed the stakeholder involvement in 7 out of 19 sessions. I started going through. Of course, I couldn't attend all the sessions. There were parallel sessions and everything else. So I started going through through the abstracts and looking at where did we really discuss stakeholder involvement. And I was quite surprised that how many different sessions even mentioned stakeholder involvement right away in the topic or just then within the articles themselves. And when I look at it, if we look at the first session, it was the first session that stakeholder involvement came to be with was waste and decommissioning. Well, of course, every one of us knows that decommissioning is starting of nuclear power plants and all of us are going to be dealing with high-level waste sooner or later. And this is one of the big stakeholder issues along with siting of new nuclear power stations. And these issues were discussed in two different articles. They discussed the role of stakeholders in the planning process of these repository sites or waste disposal sites. And there they discussed the Finland's approach to licensing and the regulatory control of geological repository for spent nuclear fuels. And then they also discussed the role of the stakeholders in the waste management process. There was an article on the radiation protection organization in radioactive waste management in the ISPRA Joint Research Center and how they use stakeholders in defining how to handle the wastes. There was an article also about the meaning of the site-specific data and dose assessments in looking at these sites and how this information should be provided to the stakeholders. There was session 7, which was titled Education and Training. There were real discussions about the roles of different experts needed to be specified. What kind of experts do you need? What kind of experts? As Vince Cavallo was saying earlier, you need to have experts who tell the story to the people in understandable terms. There was discussion about capacity building. How do you develop a radiation protection culture at school? Of course, there was a discussion session just earlier about this. And we are going to hear more about it today when there are going to be some school students coming around to the conference. There's how to share with children the basic knowledge about radioactivity and nuclear risks. This, of course, has since 2010 come even more important when we consider that there was the Fukushima accident. It was continuously in the news. Everybody saw it. It was already in the 6 o'clock news. There was no watershed. How do you explain these things to kids? Everybody has to consider that, and that is part of what we as regulators and professionals have to be prepared to do. Give this information. How do you discuss this? And there were discussions of nuclear training centers and the experience in radiation protection culture that was expanded by different nuclear operators. In session 8, protection of workers, there was discussion of how stakeholder involvement was used for occupational dose optimization. There was discussion how stakeholder involvement has been used in industrial stakeholder cooperation, especially in the EPR project that Finland is going through, and it was a comparative approach of the French and Finnish regulatory review processes for the design phase of the EPR. Session 10 at the third European Congress was the nuclear and radiological emergencies and incidents, and we saw that stakeholder involvement really is used throughout the timeline of emergency preparedness, all the way from preparedness to the post-accident management. There was discussions of how the stakeholder involvement was used in, for instance, in a development of a TMT, triage monitoring and treatment handbook for people exposed to radioactive ionizing radiation following terrorist acts or malevolence acts. There was session 15, which is radiation protection of the public. Here we discussed on how stakeholder involvement can. Here are the discussions focused on how stakeholder involvement can be used in policy development. We have different policies. We are considering that these are going to have an effect on the public. How can we get the public's attention? How can we ask them what is their opinion of this issue, and how should we take this into cooperation? Here, the Swedish regulators presented a case of how they had used stakeholder involvement in looking at clearance of materials, different rooms and buildings and land from old decommissioned nuclear power stations. We had session 18, which was recommendation standards and regulations. Here we heard from the HERCA, which is the heads of European regulatory authorities, we heard how stakeholder involvement is used in medical practices. And then we heard of stakeholder involvement, which I actually presented myself, of how stakeholders really do not like the issue of clearance because they do not understand it. And that is actually the basis of one of my research projects that I'm doing for my PhD. And then there was the final session, which was session 19, which was the radiation and society. And actually, this whole session talked about, of course, as the name already titles, about radiation and society and stakeholder involvement programs and public participation. In here, the rapporteurs for the session said that what they found from the session 19 was that we have to, as radiation protection professionals, we have to understand what the conditions for there are things that we have to set up for dialogue to be created. We have to set up the conditions. They have to be appropriate for this. The experts must be willing to understand the public and the diversity of associated perspectives. They must share a common language, and this common language must be used together with the lay public and the professionals. The baseline judgments in science and values must be appreciated, that they have to be told to the people in a manner that they can understand them, and there has to be an appreciation of all these. And there has to be capacity building so that societies can interact with the radiation protection professionals. And in regard to this, they were very happy that they already at this time in 2010, they had heard of the plans in Glasgow, and the rapporteurs at that time were very excited about the fact that the society and radiation protection had a very big role here at IRPA, and they were already thanking it in the 2010 sessions. Now, if I just say a little bit about what I believe that stakeholder involvement is and what my studies are. I am currently looking at stakeholder involvement, and I see it as an integral part of radiation protection decision making. This is not to say that radiation protection decision making should be applied in all situations. Most situations can be covered by day-to-day radiation protection professionals on the basis of that there is the ALARA principle and there are the different principles of radiation protection, which already set out quite clearly when it is about dose limitation. And it's quite an old science. We know what we are doing, and this is when we are doing about workers. But when there is a social context into the issue, or it is a policy that has a high interest in the public, these are the issues that have to be considered together with the stakeholders. And the stakeholders have to be brought into the process through different kind of methods. And of course, the identification of these methods is not the easiest. And there are many ways of doing this. And I believe that if there is somebody who says that this is the best way of doing it, they will be lying, because I think every situation will have a different kind of method. And it depends on the history of the area, it depends on the cultures in the area. How do you engage with the people, and how do you get them to be involved in the project that you want them to be involved with? I think stakeholder involvement can be applied throughout radiation protection, all the different exposure situations. We can have it in the planned exposure situations. We can discuss about clearance. We can discuss about discuss about medical exposures, things like that. These all have a stakeholder context within them, and we should seek the stakeholders that do want to be participating in these. But if there is a situation that already our regulation and legislation already define the topic that we cannot negotiate it, it's a non-negotiable topic, do not engage with the people in those situations. Because what is the point on engaging with people if they do not want to discuss with, if you want to only discuss with them and then you say in the end, I'm sorry, I'm already obliged, my hands are tight, I can't help you. If and when we do apply stakeholder involvement, we do have some great tools in our hands. I really like the IRPA guiding principles on stakeholder involvement. They are a great tool for any one of us to use if we are to start a stakeholder involvement program. But we must remember that stakeholder involvement programs do not run themselves. There are requirements that are set on the authorities and the radiation protection professionals, mainly these being that we must have the right people. We must have the communication specialist. We must have the facilitators. We must have radiation protection professionals. all of these must be in place, and they must be willing to discuss with the stakeholders at the level that they can share. They have a shared and common language, as he said previously in different presentations, and as he said already in the guiding principles. We must have organizational arrangements in place. All these stakeholder programs should be run like any other project, be it at a nuclear facility, be it at a regulator. You have to consider this as any other project. It has to be incorporated within your organization as a real project. It has to have it has to have responsible persons, it has to have objectives, it has to have a definite budget, and it has to have a timeline. Additionally to that, you have to have management buy-in. You have to have your senior management has to be knowledgeable about stakeholder programs. If they are not knowledgeable about stakeholder programs, they are not knowledgeable about the risks associated with stakeholder programs. Every stakeholder program comes with a risk. There is a risk to the authority, there's a risk to the operator or whoever is running the stakeholder program, because if you do it badly or if you do it wrong, or that the stakeholders feel that their opinions are not being taken seriously, it will come back and bite at you, and you will lose the stakeholder confidence. There are requirements for information provision. You have to change, every one of us has to change how we provide our information. We are all highly trained scientists, and that's how we like to report. We like to report in a very academic way, and we have to learn how to report in a way that is understandable to the society at large. We have to consider that we have to be always on time when we promise. If there is a stakeholder program and we promise, these are the deliverables we are going to give you and these are the timescales you are going to get them, we have to give them at that time. Because if you start delaying your project because of difficulties in providing information or providing other crucial details, it will look like you are trying to hide something. It won't look like, oh, I'm snowed under work with this other project. It looks like you are going to be trying to hide something. And there is the final and the most important thing is that stakeholder involvement projects should not be one-off projects. They should not be that, oh, we have this problem, let's solve it with the stakeholder involvement program. No, that's not how it should work. Stakeholder involvement programs should be continuous. They should not necessarily be taking a lot of time from everybody, as we heard earlier, that you cannot expect every stakeholder to be participating in everything. That's why you need to do your stakeholder analysis very carefully. Who is the person who you have to be talking about this issue for? But you have to do maintenance of relationships. Stakeholder relationships are an important part of any stakeholder involvement program, and you need to have the systems in place to be able to follow up what your stakeholders are wanting, how they are developing, what they want to be involved in. And once you get all this done, which is probably a lot easier said than done, there is going to be a whole new world for us where we can expect the stakeholders really to be a partner to us rather than being the person we are telling this is how the things are and you better just accept it. I myself consider here in my thesis, I consider that we have to really ask the questions. Why do we do stakeholder involvement? Do we have it because it gives people a sense of involvement? Do we have it because it is expected of us? Do we have it because individuals have the right to have their opinions heard? Or finally, what I think why it should be, it should be because stakeholder involvement is a way of making smart and sustainable decisions, and it gives you the opportunity to include local knowledge that could not be included in your project through professionals alone. Okay, thank you.
Well, this is a wonderful, that was a wonderful introduction by all the speakers. Thank you very much. One new theme even coming out of just this little bit of information here is that we need to have more caution in launching stakeholder engagement. It is not the one size fits all. It's not going to solve all of our problems. And as a matter of fact, feedback from our stakeholder is they'd prefer that we be more selective in our launching of stakeholder engagement and make sure that we're actually prepared to do it well with the proper resources, and resources also for the stakeholders so that they can reasonably participate in the process and reasonably expect to impact on the outcome of the process. So thank you very much. Now, we had two challenges here. What do we know, and what are our challenges for the future? So I've got 12:20, so we've got about 40 minutes to go. So let's take about 15 minutes, if we could, and talk about and share our views on what do we believe the state of the art. What do we know today about stakeholder engagement? Yes, question right here. And please, again, wait for the microphone. Okay. We're going to run this poor gentleman ragged, I hope.
I'm Ruth Weiner. I'm from the United States. And before I speak, I just want to say that one member of our panel, a lady whose name I've forgotten, unfortunately,
Lorraine,
has already made an assumption, which is incorrect. I took vacation to come here. I'm not being paid. My travel was paid for, but not my time. I used to be on the other side. I was a member of the Sierra Club. I was a very prominent spokesman for them in stakeholder involvement. And I learned, to my dismay, that I could say anything. I could talk about things I knew absolutely nothing about. And everybody sat there and said, oh, you know, she's involved. Whereas now that I'm on what my former Sierra Club friends call the dark side, I can't say anything. And I want to pose a question to the panel. There is an attitude that I sense among all of you that the nuclear industry spokespersons, whether they're government contractors like me or whoever they are, they do everything wrong. Here's what you should be doing. You're not doing it right. Here's what you should be doing. And okay, now you know how to talk to us, but you don't know how to listen to us. And it's as if we are a dog who is learning tricks, and every trick we learn, you know, shake, pause, sit, heel, every trick we learn, we get kicked just the same. So I'd like to pose the question to you. Do you ever do this kind of education in reverse? How do the stakeholders, the people who attend these meetings, talk to the professionals? Isn't that part of risk communication? If you don't immediately want to set up a barrier, it's not a good idea to start with telling us what we do wrong.
Okay, so as I understand the question, if I may kind of summarize it, your question is, how does our profession deal with trying to engage the stakeholder to elevate their knowledge levels so that there can be more productive exchanges of information and partnership in these activities? Is that fair?
Not quite.
Okay, that's fine.
It is, how can we genuinely get two-way communication, which doesn't consist of constantly having the professionals told, you're not communicating right?
Okay.
Dr. Covello yesterday had some good suggestions, and so did Dr. Grogan. But I would like to hear from the panel. Maybe I'm just seeing this through a Polaroid lens that only lets the light go in certain directions. But it seems to me this is a common theme with stakeholders.
So better two-way communication. How do we establish that? Would the panel, anyone like to respond to that? Marco?
Yes, I would like to respond. I work for the regulators, and I see nuclear industry is not who I regulate. I regulate the research industry more than I do the nuclear industry. But I think the main point is that stakeholder involvement, yeah, as you say, it's a two-way process. It's not a one-way process. But there is, which is a high emphasis also here in the ILPA 13, and as was in the third Congress in Helsinki, which was held in 2010. It's the capability building. is the capability building of your stakeholders. It is as important as it is to teach to the professionals how to make their message understandable. It is as important to increase the level of capability in the people who will be taking part in the process, because if they don't understand the basic terms and the basic issues, there is no way that they can make a knowledgeable judgment. And without the knowledgeable judgment, all the benefits of stakeholder involvement will be lost. But I would also like to add on to that that I think as professionals and radiation protection authorities, we do have to change our tack a little bit as well. We can't rely anymore on that we provide you only with this specific, that this is the result of the study, and this is what it means to you. We have to let them get the realization. We can say that this is the result, and try to explain to them that what this result means to you, and make them realize what the outcome is for them.
Okay, thank you. Lorraine?
I've tried, goodness knows I've tried. In order to be able to have that kind of two-way dialogue, which I think is the ideal, there has to be an open door. You can't keep bashing your head against a brick wall. Now, in my case, just to give you an example of that, let's go back to 9/11. After 9/11, I happened to be looking at Dounreay Nuclear Establishment's website, and I noticed that on their website, they had a complete map of the site with all of the buildings listed by number. And in another document on their website, it gave a description of what was in each building. And on another bit of the website, they gave aerial views of each building so that you would know, if you were flying a plane, you would know where the high active liquor storage tanks were, for example. So in the spirit, exactly the spirit you're talking about, I wrote to them in a letter marked private and confidential, and said, were they aware that their website gave information which, you know, really there was terrorist risk from the information that was on their website? They press released their response saying I was scaremongering. I hadn't said to anyone apart from them in a letter marked private and confidential. And that's the sort of thing that we've been up against. That may not apply in the States, I don't know. But it certainly applies here. I could tell you similar stories, not as extreme as that, in relation to the regulators, both SEPA in Scotland it is, and the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate. It's very, very difficult for a lay person to actually get in and make a perfectly reasonable and sensible point. The door is closed.
Thank you. Vincent?
When I was listening to your comment, it reminded me of one of the first activities that I was involved with in the United States on risk communication was the National Academy of Sciences, which wrote what many consider to be the Bible of risk communication in 1989 called Improving Risk Communication. And it was interesting to me that they defined risk communication as the exchange of information. Not as one-way communication, not even as two-way communication, but the exchange of information among stakeholders. It also reminded me that I went to a conference last year where it's an extension of risk communication from health, safety, environment to marital and family therapy. A number of individuals, there was a session using risk communication skills in marital and family therapy. And it began with an individual presenting on the traditional, what he referred to as the DAD model, D-A-D, which is decide, announce, defend. And how difficult it is sometimes for the dads in the world to move away from that model. I think we moved away in part when we added the word consultation. Decide, announce, consult, and defend. But it's really not that much of a movement in the direction of a true exchange of information. And the third point is that in that particular session on marital and family therapy, a number of therapists talked about that you actually have to train people to engage in dialogue. For example, a couple that's arguing with each other, you have to set up rules of dialogue. You have to let the person complete what they want to say. You have to actively listen. There are a number of skills that were being taught for all partners, that dialogue is not something where you just simply sit down across in a table, that there are rules for engagement, in this case, rules for dialogue.
Any other panel members wish to comment? Okay, very good.
Let me add some comments based on the experience after Fukushima. As I explained, our JHPS activity is kind of one-way communications. When we receive the questions, then we respond the answers. But after the Fukushima nuclear accident, there was some dialogue meeting between the inhabitants and the governments, and some risk communicator used our website, and they saw our examples of the Q&A. So I think it's very important to exchange information, the mutual communications. But there is one very big issue. After the nuclear accidents, the inhabitants become very emotional. So I think it's a very big problem after the very big accident. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, right here.
My name is Richard Vedder from the United States. Dr. Grogan indicated to us that right up front, one of the most important things is our credibility when we're dealing with a public audience or dealing with the public. Now, many of us are funded by companies that either use nuclear energy or radiation or something. In fact, the panel's been supported by the Nuclear Energy Institute and the Japanese Electric Power Institute. So my question is, does our source of funding affect our credibility? I'm really interested in Lorraine's attitude about that. Does our source of funding affect our credibility? If so, why? And what can we do about it? Thank you.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, I guess as the question's been directed at me, yes, it does. Because people believe that if you're funded by an organization with an interest, you're likely to promote that organization's interests. And also, there are situations, for example, if you look at the donations that have been made by some of the nuclear industry interests in this country to cancer research, for instance, they don't fund research which may show that there's nuclear industry involvement in cancer. It's all research into other explanations. So there is a bias. If you've got, in the same way as if you're writing a scientific paper, then you would be expected to state what your interests were. And people reading that scientific paper will regard a conflicting interest as being one of the limitations that you would attach to that paper. You don't necessarily rule it out of hand, but you certainly, it colours your view, and it ought to colour your view.
Very good. I just want to comment right now. I failed to introduce one individual up on the panel. The last gentleman is Sven Nagel. He has been remarkable for us. He personally put together the IRPA 13 Facebook page and manages that, and is also involved with the Twittering activities. And if you have problems with those new social media activities, he's a good resource, and he's conducting a refresher course tomorrow morning. So if you want to know how to do that stuff, get to his refresher course tomorrow morning. But he's been wonderful and a huge help to IRPA 13, the success of IRPA 13. So that's Sven. Now back to the business. Marco.
Yeah, I would like to respond to the last comment here. I think, in my opinion, I work for the regulators, and I think in my opinion, the regulators should be facilitating these kind of stakeholder programs. They should be seen as the third party who is not directly associated with the industry. They should be the facilitator in between of the stakeholders and then the regulatory stakeholders. So in my opinion, the authority should be the facilitator who takes the regulatory stakeholders, who are the ones, the license owners, who takes them as one stakeholder and then take the other stakeholders to come and cooperate in the process and discuss it through that way. And that will take away some of these concerns about where the funding comes from. But I think in regard to acceptability of scientific research and issues, I think the research should talk for itself and it should be given a fair chance no matter where the funding comes from.
Yes, Helen.
I'd also like to make a comment about the funding and for the work that I've been involved with Risk Assessment Corporation in the United States. We've done a lot of dose reconstructions, or that's where we first started, or my experience first started. And these were after the nuclear facilities, after the Cold War. The history of the cloud of secrecy, as it were, the veil of secrecy was removed. And the public around these facilities were very concerned about, okay, now I know what was going on there. How has that impacted us? And we actually were fortunate enough to get very involved and do these independent studies. And probably the first study was the Hanford Environmental Dose Reconstruction Study. And when that began, the panel that was overseeing all of that work that was headed up by John Till, who I work with, was funded really by DOE and the facility itself. And that really, when they came out of their first press conference, out of their first meeting, and the press was there and the microphone was placed in front of his mouth, and the question was asked, how can I trust you? You're being paid by the facility that produced the harm. And that really has been a message that we have taken very seriously, that we have made every effort always to change the way the funding is organized so that even if the facility pays ultimately, that they are not responsible for how that money gets spent, that the research and the investigation the funding and organization for that is placed separately. And that is a policy that we have adhered to strictly through all of our work. Because I do believe the source of funding, it's a big question, because immediately your credibility goes down. And how can people have confidence about your work, even if they see that you've got good intentions, if it looks like, well, but they could cut the purse strings at any moment. So trying to find an independent source for managing that is ideal. Thank you.
And in my experience, you can use such tools as the National Academy of Sciences, a university, some third party that actually does the contracting and does the management with the funds provided, but the provider of the funds is not involved in the management of the activity. We'll take one other question and then maybe we'll get on a different subject. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Jean Koch from Israel, and I have a question related to Dr. Covello's answer to the first question that communication should be, in fact, exchange of information, and to Mrs. Mann's statement that engagement should be a two-way process and not involve paternalistic attitude, statement to which I think all of us agree. But I have the following problem. Most of us in this room, I believe, think that the information we hold and that we try to disseminate is science-based and therefore is trustful and credible. But on the other side, the main stakeholder, the public, is mainly informed by the mass media. Source of information we believe is less trustful and credible. So how do we tackle this issue?
Anyone like to comment on that, Vincent?
Lorraine, is that correct?
Yeah.
Made a comment before that the finding was considered in the psychology and the sociology literature to be seminal and earth-shaking. It was offered up by Professor Paul Slovic approximately 25 years ago, and he reinforced what Lorraine said, that public concerns about risk, public acceptability of risk, public judgments of risk, are driven not by the science, but by social psychological factors. Using regression analysis, he was able to demonstrate that less than 5% of public decision making about risk deals with the facts as determined by science, that the 95% remaining is driven by factors such as credibility, trust, voluntariness, perceived benefits, perceived effects on future generations, catastrophic potential. And I believe that that particular study and that revelation that the way people make decisions as humans is that it's driven, yes, by facts, but driven by many other factors, pushes us in a very different direction from the way of explaining facts better. If only people could understand the facts better, they would understand why we're doing what we're doing. Unfortunately, that will move very little the mark in terms of any judgment of success.
All right.
Not sure I can add to that. Sounded like the perfect answer to me. If what you're saying, if people were so concerned about science, and if science was really what mattered, when I asked how many people had five portions of fruit and vegetables yesterday, every hand in the room would have gone up. It didn't. And the same applies to all of us. You're looking from within your bubble of radiological protection. I'm looking from within your bubble of radiological protection today. But that's not who you are. You have lots of other facets to your life. And then the rest of your life, you make decisions in which the science weighs a little bit and a whole pile of other factors weigh quite a lot as well. And I think what needs to be recognized is that you are bringing one piece of the jigsaw to the table. I think often it's tempting for experts in the field to think that they have the whole jigsaw. You don't. And other people have other pieces of the jigsaw which are just as important.
Yes, and I think, very good. I think that lends itself to the issue of, if we're talking to ourselves, the science is a wonderful vehicle for us to talk science with. But if we're not talking to scientists and ourselves, then we need different tools. We need a different set of skills. We need different tools. We need different approaches. Yes.
Just a really short comment, Lorraine. You may remember you were on the Agriculture and Food Council Yes. Working Group. And just to say, that gave a really good example, I think, of where there was a lot of very good scientific reasons why you should do certain types of management options after an accident. But that group had so many different ranges of stakeholders on it. And what I felt that we did wasn't base our decisions on whether to include these management options in what became our recovery handbooks on science. It was what everybody thought. And a lot of what people thought was on these other socio-psychological effects, so on acceptability. So our UK handbook has far fewer options than the European handbooks that were built, because we really, really, over that 10-year period, sort of went through again and again until we reached a sort of consensus. And if there was anybody in that group that felt, for whatever reason, that option shouldn't be there, we actually left it out. And it's a section at the back of the handbook that explains why that option was left out. And we certainly welcomed your interaction on that group, and we hope you felt it was worthwhile.
Yes, Marco.
Can I just comment on the one before on the comments, just saying that it is very difficult that when people have made up their mind about a specific issue, the mind is usually, it's made up, and it is very difficult to change it. But if it, with scientific information, if it's made in an understandable form, and if the decision that they are, if you're trying to make people to change their mind about a specific issue, it is, if they don't have to make a huge trade-off, if there are no trade-offs, that it's not going to affect them negatively to change the decision, if they understand the topic, in most cases, they will change their mind about it. If you give them earlier assurances about the issue and you have transparent information in a form that is understandable, it is possible to change people's minds. They are not just set with the psychological schemata which will decide it for the rest of eternity. You can change it.
But you had an interesting caveat there. You said as long as it had no adverse impact on them.
Yes, that is. If it doesn't include a trade-off, if it includes a trade-off that they have to make, which has an adverse impact on them, it is very difficult to change somebody's opinion.
Okay, Lorraine.
I think that also assumes that the scientific evidence is that we know everything. And actually, we don't. There are so many areas of uncertainty within the scientific evidence. And that's one of the issues where very often the scientific evidence is presented as certainty when actually it's a range of grey. It's maybe, you know, a charcoal grey, or it's slightly off-white. But very often it's presented as certainty. And I think that's what leads to many of the media reactions that come about, because you get somebody saying that something that's a kind of mid to dark grey is black, and somebody else coming along and saying, no, this mid to dark grey is white. And that's, I think, one of the places where you get these tensions building. And I think one of the things we really need to do is say, well, we're not absolutely 100% certain about this. There's a range of possibilities. We think the most likely one is, and that's something that at the moment we're very bad at doing.
So one of our future challenges is to do a better job in dealing with uncertainty and the communication of that, the explanation of it, what it means, the ramifications. Okay? If we could focus now on challenges for the future, what do we see as challenges for the future? What are opportunities for the future? What could we spend more effort, more time directed at that we think could make a difference? As an example, in IRPA 11 in 2004, stakeholder engagement session was Friday morning. It was the last little session they could slip in, okay? IRPA 13, we were Tuesday, Wednesday. That's a huge success right there. We got it moved up on the agenda. That was a huge success.
Well done.
Thank you. So what do we see as our challenges? What do we see as opportunities for the future to make stakeholder engagement more productive for all parties, more effective? How should we spend our time and resources on stakeholder engagement involvement? Sir.
Thank you. My response would be to put a question to Dr. Covella, because the reference you gave was 1985. Which is interesting.
1989, I think, the Academy study.
1989. My question is more to do with something I've learned a lot about dealing with stakeholders in the last 10 years, where the engagement process has been caused by the failure to use science as the basis of a regulatory decision, in this case taken in the US in 1989. That decision was actually taken for psychosocial reasons and has caused an enormous amount of damage since, economic, environmental, and social. It's taken a whole generation for that process to work itself through. So my question is whether there would be agreement for the future that it's not to disregard the psychosocial, but actually isn't it time for science to catch up such that for the cooperative game theory to work in the future, we don't end up caught where the nuclear debate's caught in a non-cooperative strategy, but we actually find the basis for a cooperative strategy, which is what Nash and von Neumann were actually trying to achieve. And I would suggest that we're seeing more and more that the consequences of poor use of science, overestimation of risk, etc., in regulatory processes, which have fully taken into account stakeholder concerns of an acute kind, are ignoring what I've also missed in the case studies that I've heard, which have all been focused on either BP-type risk or legacy issues, rather than the future. And what I think IRPA might want to be thinking about for the future is some attempt to predict life cycle management processes in these issues, which might include continuous stakeholder engagement and review. Because as we've also heard, what the stakeholder thinks now and what the stakeholder thinks in the future is something that we can't predict, I think. And I'd refer back to the Brundtland Report of 1987, which sees sustainable development, which is, I think, the frame within which we're all agreed we're working, as something where technology, culture, and need are all mixed in together. And getting that equitable balance correct seems to me the fundamental process for good rulemaking, but also good social development in the future. So I wonder if you particularly, Dr. Govella, would accept that perhaps some course correction there, perhaps in the favor of science, would be quite useful without losing the benefits of the understanding of the psychosocial.
Just a few quick comments. One is something that I started my personal career as an epidemiologist, and when I shifted to communication, my mother called me on the phone and said, why have you given up on science? And I said, I still am a scientist. I'm now focusing on the human mind, on the brain, how we process information. And I believe that one of the challenges is to recognize that there are other sciences that all contribute something to our understanding of how to make a decision. The other point I wanted to make was one that I'd like to emphasize, which is the dynamic nature of stakeholder engagement. If we think of this as a one-step process where we make a decision and don't recognize that these values, science changes, radiation science change, psychology changes, people's value systems change. Just think about the environment and how we place so much value now on the environment compared to even just 30 years ago. And so thinking of stakeholder engagement as a one-stop shopping where it ends and you have your shopping bag and you take it home, I think would be a serious mistake given the complexity and the dynamic nature of the interactions.
One thing that I learned this week and was reinforced this week also is that Ted Hartwell's program out in Nevada, they started in the early 80s to engage with the local science teachers and public to do their air monitoring filter exchanges on this whole network of air monitors around the Nevada test site. They've been doing that since the 80s. And the result of that was when Fukushima happened, they had a whole network of people that all knew each other, had built the credibility over 30 years, and the relationship created the credibility over that period of time. So when they put information out, it went to people in the community that were looked upon to give good information because they've been doing that for so many years. And it was very effective in dealing with that issue, informing the population in that area, because it was established and it had history. I think a real failing of the profession in stakeholder engagement is they see it as a one-time event. Okay, I have to do a policy on this, or I have to site a reactor, or I have to site a disposal site. So now I have to create this whole system from nothing and run off because my boss told me I have to site this, I have to do this thing. And then when that's done, I'm done, project's done, and we go away. We have to establish long-term networks and relationships with our stakeholders, not based on, or maybe initially based on an issue, but not based on solving one issue, one problem today, and then we all go back to doing what we always do, and you know, we're done. We're done with that. We've got to establish the networks. I think the new social media, the internet, communications and communication skills nowadays makes it significantly easier to do that. You have a list server, you do a monthly, weekly, whatever the right frequency, quarterly, annual newsletter, you send it out to your established stakeholders, and you start building that relationship. I shared a story before about the fellow who was responsible to try to expand a mission at a facility. And he did all the stakeholder things, but the bottom line, he said, was in the grocery store, people would approach him and say, okay, you know, you don't have your suit on, you're not behind the podium, we can talk now, you can tell me the truth, you know, what's really going on. And he's there with his wife and kids, and he's living in the community, and that bought him a lot of credibility. He was there, he was engaged, and it helped inform and assure and had that two-way dialogue, that communication, built that relationship of trust, built the relationship of credibility over time. So it has to be based on science, but there is also the science of communication and the science of risk communication. And I think that was really brought home this week, is this is not an add-on. This is a different science. It has different opportunities for us. It has different skills for us. It has different tools for us, and those of us that are going to be involved in stakeholder engagement need to understand this is a new skill set we need to develop. There are tools, there are resources to do that, but we have to take it upon ourselves to go back to school and to learn that, to practice it, experience it, and develop that skill set so that we can succeed as well in that science as we do in our radiation protection science. If you're not involved in that, then maybe you don't have to develop as big a skill set. But I would offer, this is a skill set that you can use daily when you go talk to your boss and for the raise, okay? That's an important thing for you. It's the same skill set. You're going to communicate effectively, or you're going to walk in and say, boss, I want a raise. Well, why? Well, because I'm working hard. Yeah, but what have you done for us today, you know? Why should I give you more money than the person in the cubicle next to you nowadays, okay? The same skill set for communications. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Lee from the U.S. What would be actually useful then after your comments would be maybe a set of recommendations coming out of our discussions on what to integrate into, say, college curriculums in nuclear engineering or health physics or the related fields, where students could pick up those skills in advance of kind of being thrown into the mix. So it would be very, very useful to the colleges and universities.
Very good, thank you. We have a question come in from the back.
Rick? Hi. Sorry.
Okay, very good.
My boss is here, so I won't sort of go into any detail about asking for a raise, but I think it's probably beneficial for us to have a closer look at using the internet. I think, using things like Twitter and Facebook and more interactive websites, things like that, there's when we get inquiries from the public, they often say to us, oh, I've been researching this on the internet. And usually that means that they've been on a load of blogs, they've gotten a lot of information that has no, that hasn't been peer-reviewed. It's quite easy to create a website that looks very genuine. And perhaps it's up to us to be a bit more proactive in putting out real information that people can find easily, rather than just putting a report on your website and saying, read this 1,000-page report.
Agreed. I was forgetful. Thank you, Sven. Do we have a Twitter question or email comment?
Yes, we have.
Wonderful. Could we have one of those?
Yeah, of course. We have an email question, and I will give it to you. What do you advise in order to involve some difficult stakeholders, like ecologist organizations and especially local or regional politicians with agendas in which radiation issues are used as an argument? They are normally reluctant to have an open and transparent involvement unless you reinforce their messages. So I think it's a big challenge to network with such stakeholders.
Okay, so the issue is how to deal with challenging stakeholders.
Yes.
Very
disruptive,
good.
Stakeholders.
Would the panel like to share any views on dealing with difficult stakeholders? Lorraine, are you interested in there? Go.
I don't think there is any such thing as a difficult stakeholder. A difficult stakeholder should be somebody who can actually give you a lot of the answers to what you're looking at. You're not necessarily going to go with what that particular stakeholder says, but the stakeholder will scope out a lot of the questions for you and a lot of the things that you need to think about. By difficult, what's generally meant is someone who doesn't agree with you. From the stakeholder's point of view, you're the guys that are difficult.
Love it. It's true. Yes, Martin.
Yeah, I think there's a... I quite agree with that, that there is no such thing as a difficult stakeholder. There is always a stakeholder, and every... As the IRPA guiding principles say, we should accept that everybody has an opinion, and everybody's opinion has to be valued. But Of course, when if a situation gets very infected, there is always two sides to the party. It's never just that there is one side who is being difficult. It's they do not see eye to eye about something. There can be situations, but there should be, if you have a stakeholder involvement program and you are already have a plan in place and it really is incorporated into your organization, there should be systems in place to counteract these kind of infectious situations, that if a situation gets very bad, then you have to have a system of resolving it. You have to either sit down with the stakeholders or you have to have plans in place before the stakeholder involvement that this is what we are discussing about and it will not go beyond these parameters, the discussion, and it will not become a situation where you are discussing a specific project, but instead it turns out to be, should there be nuclear power or not?
Correct.
I'd like to just say the particular question makes me think about one of the challenges in stakeholder engagement, and that is, how do we measure success? This has actually been one of the difficulties for many organizations. How do we determine if we're successful if we have no metrics by which to decide what is success? There's various levels of success. One would be if we start off with, I would argue, an ill-informed measure of success changed people's minds. That becomes almost an impossible hurdle, especially what we know about people's beliefs, very resistant to change, especially when there are trade-offs. But if we expand the notion of metrics and we set ourselves the challenge, how do we, for example, measure trust? Helen offered up a number of measures of trust, and you can get people to respond. How responsive do you think the organization is? How transparent do you believe the organization is? That you can develop a series of metrics that would allow you then to say whether or not you're doing better or worse than you were before. And probably the most complex, I would argue, of metrics would be, Rick, what you were talking about before, relationships. How do you measure whether a relationship is positive or negative or if it's improving? I would say that anything we can do in that regard would be beneficial, not just in terms of our understanding, but also acceptance of these other sciences contributing to the decision-making process.
Very good. Helen, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I did. I keep listening, and I can talk about really is the experience that we've found, and I know there was some criticism about science, and I keep stressing the importance of doing good science. And it's not that I am deluding myself that science accounts or makes the biggest difference on this, but if we're making decisions that are based on radiation, radiological exposures in the environment, people, you want to know that at least that core about the science is good. It may not be the driving factor at the end that makes all the difference, but I think it's very important that we are using the best science that we can always. And then when we're talking about how we really make a difference into the future, my challenge would be to say that any organization or facility that is releasing radiation into the environment so that the public are affected, so that there's implications for impacting the public, there should not be a plan that goes into action when something out of the ordinary happens. If those organizations, every organization, could think about themselves and think about how are we sharing what it is we're doing right now, making that information available, probably through the web, and you providing tools, that is how, in my opinion, you start to build up your trust and credibility, because people then can really see what's happening. It may all be good. Right now, everything's all regulated, that it's not negotiable about, say, for instance, how much is being released, but you can provide the tools that people become familiar, and you've got the exchange starting to happen, and you build up some trust there so that then when something out of the ordinary happens, like we saw for Fukushima and the monitoring network around at Las Vegas, Nevada test site area, that then there is a system in place, there's confidence is already established, and there's a network for how that information can get shared, and people have confidence about what somebody else is saying. They're not having to start at a time when they're feeling emotional to really try and understand, what is all this about? So that was my suggestion.
Wonderful. So we have to be more proactive than reactive. Yes, Sven.
We have always a few questions on using social media and stakeholder engagement. I will put out some one for okay. us, okay? Because someone asked, should using social media be considered partly as a risk because everyone is on the same level and anyone can grab authority without real facts behind them? And so how to deal with that?
Interesting. So the issue is of credibility of the source that's distributing information.
Because anyone can send out the message and nobody does know, is he a professional, does he know what he's writing about, I don't know. Yeah. How to deal with that?
Does anyone have any? We're losing the audience and it is past the 1 o'clock. Let me give my closing little statement, and then we can continue this discussion for those who are interested and would like to do that. Is that fair, or would you like to just keep going?
That's fair.
Okay. I found an amazing quote while I was here this week, and I have to share this with you. This area where we are at in Glasgow is an old burg, and it's named Anderston, and that's the name of the train station right here, okay? Their motto in 1824 for this area was alter alterius auxilio veget, which means the one flourishes with the help of the others. For me, that's stakeholder engagement. Fascinating. 1824. So with that, the session's closed. More than welcome to stay here and continue to discuss with you, as long as the panel's willing to hang in with us. Okay? So. So anybody have a response to our question? What do you do about just